start tonight. Last weekend, the legendary US comedy series Saturday Night Live arrived in the UK, 51 years after it made its debut in America. Famous for its celebrity hosts and political sketches, the show has launched the careers of everyone from Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi to Kristen Wiig, Will Ferrell and Tina Fey. But will the format work with a cast of mostly unknowns and for a non-American audience? Jen Gannon joins me now to look at the significance and history of Saturday Night Live and its new UK version. Jen, you're very welcome. Let's start at the beginning. Why does SNL hold this sacred place amongst comedians in the US?
I think it does because it's an incubator for generational comic talent. You just look back at these names that we know so well that have been through the Studio 8H doors. So you have the early days from Bill Murray, John Belushi, Gilda Radner, Eddie Murphy, Norm Macdonald, right down to Mike Myers, Will Ferrell, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Kristen Wiig and Maya Rudolph. And they're all people we might not know this side of the Atlantic. It might be a case of we never had that growing up. I remember when I was growing up, it was on Sky in the graveyard slot, so you'd rarely see it. Now with YouTube, TikTok, everything, you can catch up on clips, and it is broadcast on Sky as well. That there's more, you can dip into it more. But back in the day, you know, it was held with such reverence, I think, because you could see these people that we knew that went on to make most of our favourite American comedies, films. You could see them in their early days. You could see them when they'd just begun. There was an innate talent to, you know, the spotters, the people that actually picked these people out from audition. And can I say, that audition process is absolutely terrifying. If anybody watched the documentary, you have Lorne Michaels there, the creator, sitting in the shadows, and you have to perform in front of him and certain executive producers. There's no laughing. You barely get a laugh. So I don't even know how they make it through those auditions. But it's something, there's an innate talent there to spot these future stars. And it's had so many that have gone on, as I said, to be household names, that it is one to watch in certain ways. But in other ways, for us, I think it's held with all this reverence, and you hear all these American comedians talking about it, that you think when you tune in, it's going to be, you know, sketch after sketch after sketch of pure gold. And it's kind of shonky. And a lot of it, like if you're on TV for 50 years and you're doing a live show week after week, there are going to be bad sketches. And you would tune in and think, why is Tom Hanks wearing this wig? And you know, why is he doing a stupid dance? That's a lot of the weeks, I have to say.
I remember the first time I got to watch it properly and seeing an entire set of those. The hit rate, certainly at the time I was watching it at that stage, wasn't great. But when it hit, no. You know, it hit.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. And when you have that gold, and it is a punishing schedule, just to say, it's not only about those ace faces that you see that are in front of the camera. There is a massive writing staff for SNL, and sometimes they transfer onto screen as well. So you'll have someone like Seth Meyers, you'd have John Mulaney, you'd also have Tina Fey, who spent 9 years as a writer before being thrust into the limelight on the screen. So they work super hard, and their schedule is ridiculous. And I do think that has something to do with the output as well and the quality of the output. I don't know why Lorne Michaels keeps them to this mad schedule where they're up all night on a Tuesday writing these sketches. You know, the Wednesday they go in to a table read. The Thursday is a dress rehearsal and editing the sketches and rewriting them. And Friday the same, and then it's go on Saturday, and they're writing
and then
right
it's
up
actually
to the wire.
Live.
Exactly. And no wonder so many of them have substance abuse issues. How do you stay up all night? Like a whole Tuesday for like week after week writing and rewriting. And if you watch that behind the scenes documentary that came out last year, you'll see some of the writers nearly crying, going, I have been writing one sketch for 7 hours and I don't think I'm getting it. So that kind of denotes how the output can work or not. And some of the sketches, the more surreal side of things, more Will Ferrell end of things, you know that somebody breaking at 4 o'clock in the morning just going, this was funny, we laughed at this in the writer's room, get it down on the page. And it has that air to it sometimes. And like, I guess it's like the Muppets, sometimes you want to see the show come together in a ramshackle way, and that may be the charm of it too.
I'm going to play some clips, both from the new SNL UK as well, but from classic Saturday Night Live as well. This is, do you want to set this one up first? This is the Eddie Murphy White Like Me sketch.
Yeah, I think like Eddie Murphy was a breath of fresh air to Saturday Night Live when he came in the early 80s. And he struck them as a Richard Pryor type firebrand figure. And this was, I mean, he wrote so much great material for them at the time, but this is a spoof mockumentary, White Like Me, from 1984, about spending the day as a white man in America. So think the precursor to White Chicks. He's made up as a white man going around doing various things like going to a newsagent's and going on the bus, like fairly regular things. But there's this rawness and ridiculous to it, the lampoon and white privilege that I think the show sorely needed at that time.
And this is a moment from it. So this is Eddie Murphy in whiteface experiencing the benefits of white privilege when the black loan officer that he's being served by is suddenly replaced by a friendly white bank manager.
Harry, why don't you take your break now? I'll take care of Mr. White.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Bob.
That was a close but one.
It certainly was.
We don't have to bother with these formalities, do we, Mr. White? Huh?
What a silly Negro.
Just take what you want, Mr. White. Pay us back any time. Or don't. We don't care.
And Mr. White gets everything he's looking for. Why do you think it's taken so long for it to transfer across the Atlantic? I mean, there's been suggestions of it a number of times. It's just never come off.
For a long, long time. And I think, you know, there is obviously a wealth of talent, comedic talent in the UK and in Ireland, obviously. And I think that is something that Lorne Michaels always wanted to do, but it never quite made it. And I guess it's because there is a tradition of sketch show comedy in the UK, but it's petered out a bit. Like, you had pre-recorded shows like The Fast Show or Big Train, which was kind of cult, but people loved it. And then you had, you know, and I think that kind of moved. It went out of style a bit. Like, when I was growing up, I used to watch Whose Line Is It Anyway on Channel 4 and watch Paul Merton and you know.
One of my favourite shows on TV.
It was great. Like, but I think it moved on to, you see the shiny floor panel, those panel shows where you'd have comedians on Mock the Week or 8 out of 10 Cats, and that's getting them in front of a new audience. That's getting the new comedians out there to test out their stuff in a safe environment that doesn't have the squeaky bum kind of cringe nerves of sketch comedy. So I think something that is probably its closest comparison would be something like Taskmaster, which is absolutely unstoppable. And the reason why I think it hooks an audience in so much as well is because you get to know this troupe of certain comedians over a number of weeks, and that's what Saturday Night Live does. So maybe they felt now was the right time, with the success of something like Taskmaster, that this could go through and people would be more willing to open up to see a troupe of relatively unknowns for weeks at a time.
Part of what they must be weighing up here as well, though, is you're right, those kind of shiny floor panel shows, they're incredibly cheap to make and you can make an awful lot of them. Something like this with a big writing staff and where you have filmed elements, it costs a lot more money.
It does, and you've got the celebs as well. Let's not forget the bands that are of the moment, acts that you have to have on, and making a lot of props. Like in the US one, so much time and dedication goes into making the props where you want a severed head. Here's 10 that we've made earlier. Here's one that Bill Murray used in 1976. Who doesn't want to have that? But also, because sketches are ditched at the last moment, Lorne can come in on a Friday and say, that's out, that's out, we hate this now, that the props that they've made can go to waste. So it is big money and it is a risk. And I think when people are complaining, going, why is this on Sky? Why is this not on Channel 4? Maybe Channel 4 did not want to take the risk money-wise to put this out there where Sky has the money behind them. Whether they have the dedicated and big viewership that they're banking on, it remains to be seen, I suppose.
One of the major pluses I've seen being talked about regarding the new UK version is that the cast are all young and they're all fairly unknown, and there aren't a lot of places for that sort of talent to turn up en masse on UK TV these days.
Yeah, which I like. I mean, you're going to find these people on social media maybe, or, you know, not having a big part in a lot of TV shows, TV comedy shows. So I think that's something as well, and that's something to be commended. And of course, they should be 25. You know, this is the new guard. You want fresh new talent. And as you said, there isn't a lot of shows that are doing that are pushing people to the forefront like this. So you do have people like Anya Magliano. People might know her. She was actually on the 20th season of Taskmaster. And the viral impressionist Al Nash. You have stage and TV actor Hamid, I think it's Animashon. And there's a load of them. There's a whole host of them. And but also in the writing room, we have, you know, the very funny Irish writer Gráinne Maguire and Nathan Fode. I think people would know him from TikTok as well. So you've got so many people there that are ready, chomping at the bit to have their moment. And I think that's really commendable for one.
Okay, I want to take something from the current UK version. This is quite brief, but it's from their Weekend Update, which is their news segment that occurs in the middle of the episode. This is one of the anchors, the aforementioned Anya Magliano.
Renovations to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's new home, Marsh Farm, have been taking place over the last month, including the installation of Sky TV. So, if you're watching, Andrew, hello! You're not going to like this next bit. Also, I'm older than I look.
Going out live for a bunch of young performers like that, that must be impossibly intimidating. Like, what did you see when you were watching the episode, opening night jitters?
There was a few shakes, and I felt for George Fouracres, because there was a sketch that it was touching on Brat Summer, but through a spoof of Hamlet, where he was playing a kind of Paul Mescal playing Shakespeare, but doing it as Paul Mescal with his little mullet and his tiny chain and earring and his shorts coming in on his e-scooter. And it was funny, but he did flub a few lines and I did feel for him. But also I felt for the Weekend Update guys, because Tina Fey was the queen of Weekend Update. She's there hosting the show, watching you. So no wonder. Now, they were both great, like did it very well. But you could see that there was this tenseness there. And that's why I think starting off, I think the cold opens for me never work. They never work for like proper SNL, US SNL. I think they're pretty shocking because they go on for too long and they're just not funny. And it was the same here with the Keir Starmer sketch ringing Trump that fell very flat for me. So I think if they even started off with a pre-recorded sketch, because their first pre-recorded sketch was very, very funny. It was about like a face cream that made women look so young. They looked terrifyingly young and their partners were getting into trouble with various people. And it was actually very funny. So, I mean, something like that would maybe have steadied the ship a bit more and then gone into the live sketches.
If you really like sketch TV comedy, in particular topical sketch TV comedy, there's not a lot of that on UK TV or Irish TV anymore, is there? I mean, it is filling a gap.
It is filling a gap. And I think, you know, we had Your Bad Self, and I think a lot of people talk about
mentioned
Your
on
Bad
the show
Self
more than once in the last
yeah,
few months.
I mean, yeah. And then we had, you know, No Worries If Not, but they're all pre-recorded. And there's something about that live element that you know, they're not all stand-up, so some of them are actors, and you want that mix and you want that exuberance to it, but also that little bit of a fear factor. You want to see where this is going, and will somebody swear? Famously on US SNL, Jenny Slate swore her first time and she was axed, got rid of straight away. So you're kind of wondering, will that anarchy hold for the UK? Will they allow them to have a few swears? You know, it's weird because they are beholden to the networks. Like, Saturday Night Live has this ideal for being reckless and loose, but they're very beholden to NBC. So they have to play the game. And I wonder, will this be the same for Sky as well?
Do you think Tina Fey worked as the first guest host? It's bringing in that element of US SNL, and she is royalty from that show. But there was also an element of, well, she could in theory intimidate, you know,
I would have been terrified. Like, I as someone who loves her, I would have been terrified to know that she was out there judging me, because she does judge. Like, she has said before about US SNL that she doesn't think that the writer's room is as vicious as it used to be. And she said, when you put in a sketch and leave the room, they should all be tearing it apart. They should be tearing you apart. It's not comfortable. These are not your best friends. You're there to work. So she has a very keen, you know, tense work ethic to her. So I would have been intimidated. But she is also a really safe pair of hands to have this show, to have that first moment. She had a great moment in the opening monologue with Graham Norton, where she went through a load of British sitcom references. Loved that. Loved her little, you have to watch it because there's so many. She's doing Mrs. Slocum from Are You Being Served?
She was.
Bits of The Office. Yeah. It was well worth it. So I think having someone who is so self-assured about the realm of Saturday Night Live was a big bonus.
These days, I mean, a chunk of the success of a show like this depends on whether or not you have clips that will then ultimately work on social media. Did you see either it being written to play towards any of that, or did that make any sense?
You need a second life. You need a second life online. This will die, live and die by that. And I do think something like Weekend Update, they need to be sharper. They needed the jokes to go further. Even with that Prince Andrew joke, I was like, push it more, because it's a UK and Irish audience that have grown up on Brass Eye. They've grown up on the day to day. You want it to be toeing that line and being very edgy. And that's what makes, you know, comedy gasp worthy. And people on TikTok going, I can't believe this happened. So that's, they need that edge more, I think. But somebody like George Fouracres, I can see him. He was one of my standouts because he had this song at the very end,
I'm not sure what was going on in that song in the final
sketch. It was brilliant. Yeah. What kind of Irish was your granddad? Is your granddad? And, you know, on paper, that sounds utterly miserable, a terrible idea. But actually, it's the closest to the sweaty, surreal strangeness of Reeves and Mortimer that I wanted from that show. And I loved it. And I think when the show leans into those, you know, idiosyncrasies of UK-ness, it works better.
OK, I want to finish out with this from classic SNL. This is the iconic sketch written by and starring Will Ferrell as Blue Oyster Cult's cowbell player and Christopher Walken as the music producer, the Bruce Dickinson.
Come on, Jim!
No, come on! Steve!
It doesn't work for me. I gotta have more cowbell.
Don't blow this for us, Gene!
Could be so selfish, Gene.
Can I just say one thing?
Yeah, baby, just say it.
I'm standing here staring at rock legend Bruce Dickinson.
I'm a cock and a walk, baby.
And if Bruce Dickinson wants more cowbell, we should probably give him more cowbell.
Say, baby.
And Bobby, you are right. I am being selfish. But the last time I checked, we don't have a whole lot of songs that feature the cowbell.
I gotta have more cowbell, baby.
And I'd be doing myself a disservice and every member of this band if I didn't perform the hell out of this.
Guess what? I got a fever. And the only prescription is more cowbell.
Still one of the funniest things ever on television after all these decades. Saturday Night Live UK continues on Sky One at 10 p.m. and you can watch the first episode on Now TV and Sky. And you're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena.
It's 12 noon in London, 7 a.m. in Philadelphia. And around the world, it's time for Live Aid.
And now, to start the 16 hours of Live Aid, would you welcome Status Quo?
That is Rocking All Over the World, Status Quo, at the very beginning of Live Aid on July 13th, 1985. It really was the day that music stopped the world, and for us here in Ireland, it felt like our own history was playing out on a global stage. Live Aid was a monumental logistical miracle, but at its core was a profoundly Irish story. At the centre of the storm was Bob Geldof, the chaotic table-thumping force of nature who practically wills the dual stadium concerts into existence through sheer force of personality. Back home, the response was unprecedented. As the telethon lines lit up, the Irish public dug deep, famously giving more per capita than any other nation on earth. It was a raw, visceral response, a moment where our own historical memory and an enduring, deep-rooted commitment to famine relief took centre stage. Now, the National Library of Ireland is bringing the electricity of that extraordinary day back to life with an exhibition at the National Photographic Archive featuring over 70 rare behind-the-scenes images from the Band-Aid Trust, capturing the sweat, the scale and the spirit of the event alongside silent discos and guided yoga sessions. Joining us to discuss the exhibition, the legacy of the music and why the day still resonates so deeply with the Irish psyche is Dr. Sinead McCool. She's the Head of Exhibitions, Learning and Programming at the NLI, and you're very welcome to Arena.
Oh, thank you so much.
Sinead, tell me about the origin of this exhibition. How did it come about?
Well, the exhibition last year opened because it was the 40th anniversary of this amazing event. Hard to believe for some people that it is 40 years, but then in so many ways it is long ago. And the reason that it's in the National Library is that we hold the Band-Aid Trust archive that was generally donated to the National Library in 2017. And over the last 10 years now, almost the librarians and the archivists within, and, you know, have taken that collection. It was 400 boxes from that office, and they took it, they've digitized it and cataloged it for researchers. And this collection is now just being used, a tiny part of it, like 70 curated images of 2000, just looking at the Live Aid concert. And there's so much more to come in the exhibition, you know, with this collection being so vast.
Before I get into the photographs in this, what else is in those boxes? What does that archive amount to?
Well, it's the whole of the administrative material. So it's artifacts, it's 3D objects, it's recordings, it's photographs of the, you know, the ships. It's got faxes, it's got letters from school kids, because there was school's aid, there was fashion aid, there was sports aid. And so really it is literally that snapshot of that period. And the photographs that are in it from Live Aid were part of a collection that made it into a book that... And on the front of the book, you can actually look at the book and the exhibition as well. As it just says, this book saves lives. So everybody, you know, the whole thing of that concert just became this massive enterprise. And then for years and years afterwards, the collection grew and grew and grew with the funds from that being in Africa. So it's an incredible archive.
Talk to me then about some of the shots that you chose, because some are iconic, but then some of them are much less known.
Well, I suppose the first thing to say is that the photography that was taken on the day, the material that ended up back in the office, as it were, in Band Aid. So we have a number of the sort of iconic shots that you would find. But when we were doing it, we weren't looking as, let's say, the most iconic photograph. We were storytelling. So the way that it's laid out is it's reproduced on sort of on cardboard. So the idea being is we wanted to look at the sort of the pop magazine type thing, that it's sustainable in an exhibition scenario, but it's also this idea that people used to put on their walls or, you know, fill up scrapbooks at the time. And the designer from Anchor Studios, he came up with this idea to use the Memphis style. So this is the circles and the dots and the colour. So it's a really, really vibrant, colourful exhibition. And I co-curated it with my colleague, Nikki Ralston. So what we did was, historian laid it out chronologically, the day, so that you come in at Wembley, you come in Philadelphia, and they meet in the middle with amazing image of the crowd. And then we have the television in the middle of it, sort of doing the television audience, right? So the idea being was that people would feel it. So we've got major images of faces blown up in the hope that people will come in and maybe see themselves. But it's also to give the sense of it being this young people's event, but at the same time, the artists are there. So the piece is that as you walk through the door, you've got Bowie, and Bowie's holding up the brochure from the day, and he's standing there. But we wanted to look at it from the point of view of quotations from the songs. So obviously, "We Can Be Heroes Just for One Day" is the sort of the his quote. And then you move along, and obviously Bob Geldof, his hand raised in the air. We have him really large, but people will know from maybe watching the footage that he raises his hand in the air and he says, you know, the lesson today is how to die, in the context of, you know, do you like Mondays, but that this was underpinning a famine in Ethiopia and that it was raising money to feed the world. And what we've asked, and we've worked with the Ethiopian community in Ireland, and they've made a statement about not wanting us to show images of their people and that famine, but we're going to be working with them, and they're going to give us their own interpretation later this year on the upper floor, and their response. But we're still working on that, and we're still gathering data from them.
Okay, I want to take some, just occasionally, little pieces from the day itself here.
Sure.
We have this. This is one of the most iconic moments of the day. And it is one of those moments that I'm fairly sure that Freddie Mercury had no idea was going to go the way it went. He may have hoped that. And I'm fairly sure the crowd had no idea what was going to happen next either. This is Freddie Mercury.
Help! Help! Diddle. Diddle. All right.
Freddie Mercury playing the crowd at Wembley like a musical instrument. And you see how some of the artists sort of misread the brief in this, while others, obviously like Freddie, completely nailed it.
Well, I suppose when you read and learn that he actually rehearsed for 3 days, I think that the idea of somebody being a professional to their fingertips, he looks like he is just doing it spontaneously, but yet it's this crafted and obviously has stood the test of time. But I suppose when we think about the artists at the time, you've got the David Bowie and you've got Mick Jagger and you've got Tina Turner and that sequence. So there was quite a lot to choose from. But I suppose what we were really thinking about with the programming as well was, how do you actually take static images and you look at it in the context of, you know, what people will do or how people will respond? And so when we do the Global Jukebox Tour, you have this idea that the tour guide tells you the stories, okay, but they also play the clips, and it's their interpretation of that particular day. A lot of them are too young to have actually experienced it, but they actually are responding to it in the same way. So it's very individual as that Global Jukebox Tour happens. But then when we were thinking about the, how could you bring in people into the space and how could they have this sense of the unity and the sort of the feeling of the day? And that's really being created by the yoga sessions and the well-being sessions and the sound baths, which I know really appeal to people now for this sort of relaxing and coming together. So experiencing the space, listening to music, but also to be actively in the space, but not in that sort of way of a concert, but in the communion and the coming together, which has really worked really well. People have really responded to that.
What sort of people are you getting coming along to the exhibition?
Well, I suppose this was really the idea of the yoga was really geared at the, you know, the Generation X and the and people that were millennials, in the sense that they were, we wanted them to have it because they might know the music, but they may see it. So we have the people who come for nostalgia. What we found with the silent discos, and this was a revelation to me, is in Ireland, we don't have actually silent discos. They are actually, we all listen to the same song and they are karaoke en masse. So we had 160 people the last time. Now, coming in and out, right? So we managed to keep it, you know, it was very civilized. They came in, there's no charge. And yeah, you have to book for those and NLI.ie. But what I'm saying is that you come in and people are coming in and out. So the people that we did have, the people who danced around their handbag, there were the people that were older, but that was a whole mix of people. That was a mixture of tourists, that was young people, that was people who didn't know exactly what we were doing, but were curious and passing by and meeting House Square. So what I found about it was just pure joy. So we did it before Christmas and we've done it like and we're doing it again in April. But the idea being is it's the joy of the event and those iconic people. And then you've got their images on the walls, and it really has a lovely setting.
It was hard enough to find images of Bono on the day, as I understand it, because he spent so much time in the pit.
Well, but he was also not as well known then. So you don't have the same training of the, you know, the photographers were really taking sets of photographs of people that they know would sell into the pop magazines. And what we ended up having, there's photographs of him backstage and he's wearing his big hat and he's walking around and he looks so young. And and then you've got all of them, you know, they're drinking Pepsi backstage and they're, you know, having MTV interview them. And they really, a lot of them look quite starstruck in relation to the other people that they're looking at. And you can see that it's a big moment for a lot of these artists. But yeah, so we do have some images, but only one black and white. So it looks like it's deliberate in the exhibition. It's color, color, color. And then you've got this black and white. But that was because there wasn't as many images to choose from.
Okay, I'm going to take this from the Live Aid album. This is Bono and U2 at the very beginning of Bad.
We're an Irish band. We come from Dublin City, Ireland. Like all cities, it has its good, it has its bad. This is a song called Bad.
I'd love to be able to play you more of that, but it is 12 minutes long. That's U2 and Bad from the day of Live Aid. As a historian, Sinead, looking back at this event, I mean, the scale of it is astonishing given the run-up time that there was and the technology that was available at the time.
I suppose when I say historian, to me, I think, well, this is a very particular genre of musical historian. So I would say that looking at it from a historic point of view is more about the 1980s and the idea of, as you say, technology. There's images in the midst of the photographs and there's satellites. So even as you go into the exhibition, we didn't go anywhere else to look for photographs. So with the satellite that's used in the little film when we were trying to recreate a 1980s sort of sequence is the satellites that were included because they were the, you know, the most advanced technology of the time. They used military satellites. They got, you know, broadcasting companies all over the world, 150 countries, excuse me. They, you know, they say it's 1.5 or 1.9 billion people tuned in. And then you think about all of the roadies, all of the managers, all of the hairdressers, all of the, you know, the just the amount of the technical people and apparatus that was required to be able to create this moment. And then you hear that it all happened within 6 weeks and it is the completely mind-blowing. And then you remember this is somebody who actually opened the exhibition. And when he was there, you know, Bob Geldof is still an activist. He's still campaigning. The underpinning of this concert lived on. It became something that he and the people that worked with him have lived for 40 years. I mean, that's why you feel really privileged to be in the role. And that's why I think it's really important that it is in a national cultural institution, because it is so much and says so much about the Irish nation. And so many of the artists have Irish connections.
Dr. Sinead McCool from the National Library of Ireland, thank you so much for joining us tonight on Arena. All of the events taking place at the Live Aid at the National Library of Ireland exhibition in the National Photographic Archive in Temple Bar. It runs till 2027. You've plenty of time. Exhibition is free and open to the public every day from 10 to 4. There's no booking required. But for information about the events surrounding it, like the Global Jukebox Guided Tour and the 90s Silent Disco on the 10th of April, you can visit nli.ie. Now, set in Amsterdam in 1642, Barbara Leahy's debut novel, Rembrandt's Promise, tells the story of the famous painter and his mistress, the impoverished widow Ilse Dürks. Taking place during the Dutch Golden Age, the novel reimagines the story from the perspective of a wronged woman seeking justice. This new historical work is winning praise for its rich detail and evocative prose. Its writer, Barbara Leahy, joins me from RTE's Cork studio this evening. You're very welcome.
Hi, Rick. Thank you for inviting me.
The novel, Rembrandt's Promise, it centres not on one of the world's most famous painters, on Rembrandt, but on the largely forgotten woman, Ilse Dürks. So what was it about her story that made you want to tell it from her perspective?
You know, Ilse Dürks has been largely forgotten. Rembrandt famously had two muses in his life. His wife, Saskia, and later on in life, his lover, Hendrika. Both beautiful women. He's immortalised them both in his paintings. And poor Geertje was very much forgotten, even though Rembrandt spent 7 years of his life with her at the height of his fame. So it was a revelation to me to find out about this other woman who we've heard so little about. And the more I delved into her story, the more I became intrigued. She was a woman who was in a serious relationship with him. She believed that he would marry her. It didn't work out like that. And what she suffered after the fallout of their relationship was just horrific. And she really has been misrepresented for so long. I wanted to tell her side of the story and show her for what she was, you know, a remarkable, courageous woman who stood up for herself at a time when you know, she stood up against probably one of the most famous and wealthy men in Amsterdam at a time when it wasn't easy to do so.
How did you come across the story in the first place?
So, I always knew I've always been interested in art, and I knew the broad story of Rembrandt's life. So It was, I came back to the story. I knew he had had this young wife who died very tragically, probably of TB. And I knew that this had a great impact on the artist. And I was interested in reading up on that story. And then I also was very interested in the woman who supported him in his later life. But the story of Hirtje was a revelation to me. I only found out about that through little footnotes in biographies, very brief mentions. I mean, in more recent times, she's garnering a page maybe in the biography or, you know, a little bit more. But generally, she's mentioned as a kind of fly in the ointment or a hindrance to the great master's output, because his relationship with Hirtje began after his first wife's death at a time when his artistic output was low, presumably, well, probably because he was grieving. But that low output has actually been blamed on Hirtje. A lot of his domestic and financial woes have been blamed very unfairly on her, I think. And really, the devastation he wreaked on her life was just so catastrophic. And I wanted to tell the story of what happened to her, not have her as just this footnote to Rembrandt's life.
There's a real rise in novels that fictionalize the lives of artists and the people around them in particular, those people who maybe there's not an awful lot known about. What do you think draws writers and readers to those stories?
Well, I think we love to discover, you know, the other side and get the insight, you know, this perspective from the other side. Yeah, I mean, we've all seen the huge success of Hamnet, and it's you know, it's a fascinating look at the character we're looking at Shakespeare from a completely different viewpoint because we're looking at it from the Anne Hathaway or Agnes's view. And yeah, these people who've been, a lot of the time they've been glossed over, I think. Certainly in Rembrandt's case, he's such a national hero and has been for years. One of the great critics, Gary Schwartz, talks about this whitewashing of Rembrandt. He was presented, you know, as this perfect man, this genius. And of course, we have to remember never to confuse a genius with a saint. And there is another side.
I would presume that one of the challenges writing Hirtje is that extraordinarily little is known about her. So a lot of what survives comes from legal documents, for instance. You've got to essentially build a believable inner life for her from almost no actual evidence.
That's right. We don't even know the year of her birth. It's thought to be either 1605 or 1610. We know that she was born in Edam, a small town north of Amsterdam. We know she left home very early and went to work in a tavern in a port city, Hoorn. So she would have seen a bit of life. She was married quite young, and her husband died within the first year of marriage. So the story, my story begins when Hirtje comes to work in Amsterdam, in Rembrandt's household. And it's here really that we can pick up the sort of the skeleton, the bones of her story from the legal documents that are still extant and that describe her marriage, her will, and later her, I suppose, what you could call her divorce proceedings against Rembrandt, the whole legal argument that she took on in their separation.
There's a really painterly quality to your writing, which is, you know, very much in keeping with the subject matter, particularly in descriptions of light and shadow. Was that something that you were conscious of when you were writing the novel?
Well, yeah, you can't look at Rembrandt without being conscious of light and shadow, of course, because of the chiaroscuro. This is his, you know, trademark. We have the very famous self-portrait of Rembrandt where half his face is in darkness. And at the time, you know, it was revolutionary because why, you know, an artist would present themselves, you know, to show off their face to its best advantage. But Rembrandt chose to show the effect of the shadow on the face. So that was something I was very conscious of. And I think it's it's a good metaphor for the Dutch golden age. You know, we have this amazing explosion of art, of culture, but we have the dark side of that as well. And, you know, we now know a lot more about the slavery that funded a lot of the success of Amsterdam's merchant class. And of course, these were customers of Rembrandt. And there is that dark side too. And I suppose I was very conscious in, I wanted to show Rembrandt from Hirsch's point of view, but I didn't want him to be black and white. I wanted him to be a nuanced character. And so I had to get a little bit beyond, you know, I didn't want to show all bad. I wanted to show these good sides to his character as well. We see him as a very loving husband to Saskia. We see him, you know, as very a grieving man. There's a lot of compassion and empathy in his work. So that fascinated me as well. Yeah, the shades, I suppose, of light and dark.
I'm really interested in you moving from short stories to a full-length novel, at least in part thanks to winning the Irish Writers' Centre Irish Novel Fair. Can you tell me a little bit about that progression in your career?
Yeah, well, I always wanted to write a novel, but was intimidated by the form, I think. And I had come across Hirsch's story. I really wanted to tell her story. It wouldn't leave me alone. But I kept sort of putting it off, saying, oh, no, there's so much research. You know, how am I going to do this? I don't know anything about Amsterdam in this era. And then I'm in a writing group and we meet every 2 weeks. And so I was writing short stories with the group. But then along came COVID and we couldn't meet anymore. And we went online with our group and I just had an hour and ever moment and said, right, I'm just going to give it a go. You know, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, but I'm going to give it a go. So I wrote a scene that I started the research. I was researching all the time, really, as I was writing. Suddenly I had a chapter, I had 10 chapters, and I just kept going. And yeah, I knew about the Novel Fair competition run by the Irish Writers' Centre. And before I had the novel even finished, I sent off an excerpt and I was really lucky to be chosen as a finalist. So I got to go to Dublin to pitch the novel to a room full of agents and publishers. And it was terrifying and exhilarating. And yeah, and I met my wonderful agent, Ger Nicol, on the day, and Deirdre Nolan from Eru, who just understood what I was trying to do straight away. So it was life changing.
What's it like now having the book out in the real world?
Oh, it's, you know, I feel so privileged, Rick. I'm so lucky to have, you know, to have broken through that tough wall that is the publishing world, you know. I feel very lucky. There are so many wonderful writers, so many talented writers out there, you know, who really have something to say, and not all of them get to publish their works. So, yeah, so it's a privilege. It's wonderful. I've had an amazing year. It's almost exactly a year now since the novel came out. And I love hearing people's reaction to it. And yeah, it's been great.
Barbara Leahy, thanks a million for joining us tonight on Arena.
Thanks so much, Rick.
Rembrandt's Promise is published by Eru, and Barbara will be one of the featured writers at this year's Cork World Book Fest, which is taking place from Tuesday the 21st to Sunday the 26th of April. She'll be joining Jamel White for a conversation with Sarah Hart on Thursday the 23rd of April at City Library. It is a free event. You'll find more details at corkworldbookfest.com.